coming to you direct from the nerve center of the galaxy's greatest comic. This is the 2000 AD Thrillcast.
Next month, the Treasury of British Comics is going to be reprinting Marnie the Fox from Buster comic between 1974 and 1976. Written by Scott Goodall with art by John Stokes, this pastoral tale of a young fox cub who finds himself thrust into a dark and dangerous world is a kind of watership down Tarka the Otter, Bambi-esque story, which is just beautifully illustrated. And this week on the 2000 AD Thriller Cast, we're going to be talking to the artist John Stokes, who has had a remarkable career in comic books, going all the way from working on Buster and Lion through Action 2000 AD, Star Wars, Doctor Who, Star Trek, and even becoming the inker on Grant Morrison's The Invisibles. His story is one not just of the changes in his style, but of the changes in the British and the Western comic book industry. So it was a delight to get John on the phone to talk about everything from drawing foxes to drawing Fishboy, from rendering the 13th floor to painting theatre sets. Let's talk a little bit about how you came to be working in comics, because I mean you were born in India, weren't you?
I was born in Bangalore, India, yes. And in fact, my family left in 1947 during the partition riots.
Right, right. And in terms of that upgrade, I mean, you know, you were very young. What memories do you
have? I was eight on the boat coming home.
So. Wow, wow. I mean, what memories do you have of that childhood?
Very little, really, because, I mean, to all us kids, India was the normal thing. We didn't really remember anything, the sort of things you feel you ought to remember about an Indian childhood. Mm. I do remember the partition riots, though, because my dad was stationed in Amritsar, which was in one of the worst places in the Punjab, and obviously we couldn't stay there. So we had to go up into the Himalayas, into our summer house, to spend the winter of 46-47 there. And it was the worst winter for years, and tigers and bears were coming up down out of the high mountains. And at night, our dog would suddenly bristle and he'd growl at the corner of the room and really take on alarmingly. And in the morning, when we went out, we would find like bear tracks all around our house.
Good God! I mean that's remarkable. I mean this to a certain extent, this is a world that has gone. You know, things have changed so dramatically in India and Pakistan as well.
That's right. But they're all very mundane memories. I remember the three kids up the road who were the caretaker of an Italian lady who lived just about a few hundred yards from us. They were my first playmates, and I spoke Urdu before I spoke English because I was always playing with them. They just disappeared overnight. They were Muslims in a Hindu area, and the riots were getting really, really severe. And I don't know what happened to them. They must have got on a bus, I guess, and just departed without telling anybody, which was the sensible thing to do. You know, had a Hindu mob caught the bus, they would have just rolled it over the edge of the road and let it bounce down the hillside. So whether they survived or not, I don't know.
What kind of influence do you think this part of your childhood has had on you through your life?
I really don't know. I mean, it took me sort of 40 years to go back to India, and then I never went back to that place we were living in. So it was pretty bad. You could look out every night and see fires burning on the plains. And when we eventually left, we had to take a train ride down from the Himalayas to Bombay. And there'd been a refugee train through on the other line, which had, you know, there were just slaughtered bodies everywhere. The cow catchers were just like pushing them off the line. You know, those sort of things you get on Western trains to get buffalo off the line. They were just scooping up the bodies and sort of depositing them at the side of the rail. So it must have had, I can't really say what effect it had, but it must have had some sort of effect.
This interview has taken a rather dark turn at the very beginning, which I wasn't quite expecting. I'll be honest with you.
start heavy and lighten up. That's always my motto.
What was your father's role?
He was in the army, in the British Army in India.
And so he was just part of the forces that were effectively garrisoning the country.
That's right, yes. I mean, it was a difficult situation. It was really very like we saw later in Bosnia, in that officialdom said don't intervene. So if they were trying to guard a refugee column that was attacked, they weren't allowed to do anything about it, in the way the British soldiers in Bosnia weren't allowed to fire on Serbs if they were massacring Bosnians and things like that. So sadly, he died when I was only 20, so I never really got a chance to talk to him about it. But it must have been a very difficult time.
I mean, you say you don't know how it's influenced you. I guess looking at some of your work, particularly Marnie the Fox, which is something that we'll come on to, it has a mix of the playful, the innocent, but also there is that kind of darker edge to it. There's that darker side. Do you think perhaps to a certain extent this has given
it
you an appreciation?
It could well be, Mike. I mean, I've never... Until all this stuff came up, I mean, I suppose I thrust it to the back of my mind, but it's been so ever-present that I haven't been able to ignore it any longer. So I suppose I've thought about it a lot, and lots of memories have come back to me. We went to the local town for one evening in the winter for provisions and things that we needed, and a riot broke out, and Muslim shops were being burnt. Rickshaw boys are running up the road with 8 or 10 watches on each wrist, you know, that they looted. And one big bearded, well, he looked to me, huge, big bearded guy, leant down to me and he said, "You British will be next."
Oh, crumbs.
I mean, that I think that sort of blotted all my other memories out from then on.
It doesn't strike me as a place and a time where comics would necessarily have been a particularly big part of your life.
I didn't read a comic until I was 9 years old.
Wow.
I mean, I don't know if my dad was either extremely adventurous or he seriously got up the noses of his superiors, but he was always posted to places like up on the northwest frontier, like Rawalpindi and Quetta, where you wouldn't go these days without a flak jacket. So, I mean, I just had the weirdest childhood. I really don't think I saw a comic until we came back to England, and I would have been about 9 or 10. I mean, the first one I remember, no, I must have seen things like Lion before then, but the one I remember vividly was the week that Ego came out.
Right. Well, the great and venerable Eagle. What was the effect of seeing that for the first time, not having had, you know, necessarily a great versing in comics? What was the effect on you?
I was overwhelmed by it. I mean, I suppose I had seen other comics, but just the quality of the production, the beautiful printing, the better paper, and the quality of the artwork of people like Frank Hampson and the all the various artists that they had on there. I was just bowled over.
And was this because you'd moved back to Britain?
Yes.
Right, okay.
And that was incredible. I mean, you know, we took India for granted. That was just ordinary. But, oh boy, the exotic food we had here, you know, chips and things like that. And my brothers and I used to ride around on the Circle Line, just looking at that, amazed at all these houses, which were exactly the same. We'd never seen anything like that. You know, suburbia was just such a culture shock to us.
It is remarkable that you're able to go through that transition and remember that transition as well.
Well, I would have been 9 or 10, so I was just beginning. You know, my memories begin from that date. Really, I just remember silly little things in India, but nothing. None of the things people say. Oh, you lived in India for 8 years. You must have incredible memories. Well, I don't remember any of those sorts of things you think you should remember.
Let's talk about how you go from being a 9-year-old boy seeing Eagle for the first time through to being at art college at 13. I mean, were you a progeny? Was this, you know...
My father, like most people who left the Indian Army, he just could not settle.
Right.
He tried also every army officer who came back was guaranteed a civil service job. Mm. Well, he stuck his for about 6 weeks, I think, and then he got a job. I mean, there was no. I know we'd had radar by then, but it wasn't universal. So he got a job tracking locust swarms across the deserts of Ethiopia, so that he could radio ahead and warn where they were heading for. So it was just him, his Land Rover, his gun, and his dog. And he was completely self-sufficient, so we didn't see him for about 3 years, I think. So he did that sort of thing. And he tried a small holding in Wales. And then eventually we ended up in Guildford. And I was, you know, I'd had to change schools from the Welsh school. And they said, well, let's go and talk to the art school, because you'll be going there in 3 or 4 years, we might as well make a connection. And the people at the art school said, well, why wait, you know, let him come now. And my parents said, well, he's only 13. And they said, that's all right, we'll educate him, we'll give him an art education and a formal education. Well, Mike, that turned out to be like Friday afternoons at the end of every term, you know. So, but the art education was brilliant, except that I was too young to take the exam. So I ended up being 7 years in art school. I mean, 7 wonderful years. And I learned such a lot, you know, about art and life. But I literally grew up then.
And in terms of where you were being pushed in this direction, because I assume at that time, somewhere like art school didn't look too kindly on comics as an art form.
Well, I mean, I was heavily influenced by my brother, who was George, who was 4 years older than me and was an illustrator. And by the time I was 13, he was working in an art studio, just opposite Foyles, I think it was, in London.
Okay.
So I just used to slavishly copy everything he did. And I mean, I could draw. I probably did it quite well. But they took one look at all this stuff and they said, you know, you've got to find your own style. For the first year or so, we're just going to put you somewhere completely different. I don't know quite where, maybe the sculpture department. And then they said, do you know much about theatre? And I said, no, I brought up in India. And never been. Well, I did go and see Wee Georgie Wood in pantomime. That's me in theatre. So they said, great, we'll put you in the theatre design department for a year, and then you can start completely fresh. And it was a brilliant idea. It worked completely, because I suddenly couldn't rely on anything I'd learned from anybody else. My style had to be completely my own. And I grew to absolutely love it. And so from then, I mean, that was my career plan all my time in art school. I used to look at comics and things and think about it, because I could see that George was doing stuff for the Express by then.
Yeah.
But my real plan was to be a set designer.
Well, let's talk a little bit about this this alternative career, this other career that you've had in the theatre, before we come into more detail on the comics. Because I mean, this life has run in parallel to your work in comics for many years, didn't it?
Yes, the whole of my career was split between the two things. Not always to the benefit of either of them, I've got to say. When I was working for DC, some of the editors used to get very ratty, and one guy, I think it was Dan Raspler, I can't remember what he was editing at the time, anyway, he said of me, oh, John, I don't know if I want to work with him. He's a Renaissance man, he said. He goes off and directs operas. And he didn't mean it in a complimentary fashion. So it has been, I mean, it's been brilliant and I've loved it, but it's been a drawback.
Mm.
And similarly in the theatre, I used to have a hard day working in the theatre, have to go home at night and get the pen and the ink out and start inking comic pages. So it probably didn't benefit me. I'd have had a better career if I'd done one or the other, I think. But that's not a complaint. I mean, I love the way everything has turned out.
Well, in terms of what you were doing in the theatre, you know, how did things do? Did you go straight from just kind of designing sets to do more elaborate things?
No, not really. Because that's how I came into comics. Because we, you know, having done this 7 years in art school, I then got a job at the, I think the first job I got was at the paint frame of the Old Vic, painting other people's designs, scene painting. And I had a four-figure salary. I think it was about sort of £3.16 and tuppence. The pay was awful. I mean, the pay in theatre, it's a legalised form of slavery, really. They know you love it. They know you've got to do it. So they think, fine, we'll pay them the least we can. And at the same time, George was sort of moving up through various things and saying, well, look, I really can't do this job someone's offered me. Do you want to do it? So that's how I began on my twin track.
So what were the first things you started doing with that George was handing you?
There was a little publisher just off Fleet Street.
Yeah.
And, I can't even think. Ace Publications, I think they were called. And I used to do, first of all, it was little two-page historical things like the English Civil War and things like that. And I did quite a lot of those. And then I started to write and draw, I think it was a story called Dirk Cutlass, a pirate story. And by the time I'd done a few months of those, I started to get my first things really, really big jobs from Fleetway, Edward Bensberg on War Library. I did a couple of them.
We've had various people on the podcast over the last couple of years who've been working in the same sort of time period as you, and you know, one thing that we've always talked about is how fundamentally different the industry was back then.
Oh, totally, Mike. I can't tell you how different it is. Well, I'm never absolutely sure whether it was me or the industry, but it was like a sort of secret cell somehow. You had your connections. You had your immediate editor. And you got scripts from this writer which you didn't know, and that was it. It was a bit like, have you seen the film The Battle of Algiers, where the Algerian rebels deliberately make three-man cells, so if a cell is broken, they can't even under torture give away anybody else? Well, the comic industry seemed like that to me. if someone had tortured me, I couldn't have told them who was drawing the script that was published next on the, you know, page 7 and 8 next to mine.
that is a wonderful analogy that I think a few creators might be nodding along with.
But as I say, I never know whether that was me or not, because soon after I started working regularly for Fleetway, I moved up to the Norfolk Broads, and we lived on a houseboat for 3 or 4 years. So it could have been a self-imposed isolation, and everybody else was meeting in the pub every evening and sort of swapping stories and getting to know one another. But I don't think so, because, I mean, I worked with Scott Goodall, who wrote Marnie, for 7 years on Fishboy, another 2 years on Marnie, and then another year after that on, I can't remember what the strip was called, something about children during the Nazi occupation of the Channel Islands.
The War
so
Children.
That was 7, 8, 9. That was nearly 10 years altogether.
Right.
And I never once spoke to him on the phone. I never once met him. Up to the day of his death, we never exchanged a word, which was weird because we must be one of the longest affiliations in the history of British comics.
I mean, that is remarkable. I mean, it strikes me as part of the whole thing of comics not having credit boxes, not crediting their creators.
I'm sure that was at the root of it, you gradually learnt, you know, who some of these Spanish and South American artists were, but that was all you ever, if you knew their name and could recognise their work, that was all I could do. There were no fanzines or anything like that, the sort of things that people have now.
Your relationship with Scott, you worked on, as you say, on Fishboy and Marnie, and it was The War Children, I think, was the strip that you were referring to.
Yeah.
I mean, as you say, that was substantial working relationship. Was there really no communication beyond what was in a script?
No, none whatsoever. Wow. I mean, I don't think he even wrote his scripts directed to me. They didn't sort of say, John, can we do this or anything like that. Everything was fed through the editors. So really, the only person I had any connection with was the editor, who was, what was his name? He was a lovely man. It'll come to me. And Deskin was the assistant editor.
Right. Okay.
And apart from that, you know, they would, if anything came up, they were the ones who would say, you know, can you make it a bit more this or a bit more that, a bit less that.
Let's talk a little bit about Marnie, because we are reprinting it for the first time in a new edition through the Treasury of British Comics. Can you tell us a little bit about how it came to be? Because was it just, you know, the editor gets in touch with you or your agent and says, well, we've got this new strip, we want you to do it, or was the communication directly with you?
I didn't have an agent at that time.
Right,
I've only ever had one agent for about a year or two. And so literally I just got it through the post from... Oh, I wish I could remember his name. Whatever was it? Anyway, I got it through the post from the editor and said, you know, I must have still been, looking at the dates, I must still have been doing Fishboy at the same time. But it was obvious, you know, after that length of time, he'd been around the world about twice and had met every form of fish living and breathing. So it was obviously coming to an end. And then I just got this script saying, you know, can you do this next?
I mean, again, you know, I don't want to dwell on it, but that's a remarkable way of working, because...
It was really weird, yes. Yeah. I mean, compared to nowadays, you look back on it, it seemed perfectly normal at the time, but it was very strange.
So tell us a little bit about the beginning of Marnie, the early days, because originally you wanted to draw it in a certain way that actually human beings were virtually cut out of it.
That was one of the things in the script.
Was it right?
That was Scott's idea, that he wanted to focus on the animals. And in one of the early scripts, maybe even in script one, where Marnie runs up against, or maybe one or two, where he runs up against the farmer who eventually kills his mother. And it said, you know, all human beings should be shown from the knees down. You never see anything else. Well, I mean, it's a nice idea, and I see what he was driving at. But in terms of actually pictorial stuff, it means you couldn't go any, you know, there were no long shots, there were no establishing shots, anything like that. So that fairly quickly went out of the window.
And was that an executive decision that you made?
It was, I think, yes. I think I tried it that way, and it just looked so boring. It was as if somebody was trying to direct an epic, and they never took the camera away from sort of waist-high shots. You just need a long shot, and there's times when you've just got to see everything that's going on. Besides which, none of the human characters would have had any sort of personality at all. So, yes, that did go fairly quickly. It was never, I never phoned up and said, this isn't going to work. I just decided and drew it the way I thought. And the deadlines were so tight in those days that there was no question of anybody sending it back and saying, oh, can you do this again? Because we seem to be always up against the publication date.
So what sort of turnaround were you looking at on an episode of Marnie?
Well, at the time I started Marnie, I think I was doing about three other strips. I was finishing off Fishboy, and I can't think what it was, but I was doing something else. There was a time, which was just horrendous, where I was doing something like 7 pages, 8 pages a week. So a lot of times on Fishboy, I would start an episode at 9 o'clock, knowing I had to get it in the post by 5:30. And I don't know how I did it. I mean, I would literally have to do a panel every half hour.
And in terms of the sheer number of pages you would get through in a week, say, while having, I presume, you know, this another job with the theatre stuff, how many pages were you producing?
For a few months, for about 4 or 5 months, I think I was literally, doing six and sometimes 8 pages a week. But that was really killing. You know, I couldn't keep on at that rate. So I then dropped back to about four, I think.
Okay.
At the same time as doing Marnie or the other strips for Buster and Paw. I was sometimes filling in for South American guys who were falling behind, so I did a stint on Kelly's Eye for a while and things like that. There was a football strip, I can't remember what it was in, called Raven, a sort of gypsy boy who was an ace footballer. I filled in on that for a while. So there was always something else going on at the same time. But with Marnie, I just knew I had to give it my best shot. I mean, Scott was living in Devon, and he obviously had loved books like Tarka the Otter. Mm. And he had just put so much descriptive writing into some of these scripts that I just knew I had to give it my best shot. So that was always, I always prioritized that. And I tried a lot of different techniques at first. Obviously, as you look at the later ones, I stopped doing the spatter and all these thumbprints and things like that because it was just getting too laborious.
What was it about, I mean, you mentioned the effort that Scott was clearly putting into it, but with a strip that is on such a tight deadline, where you're doing lots of other stuff, is it personal pride? Is it professional pride that means you go, you know, I want to do my best on this. I want to go that extra mile.
I think it just must have been the script, Mike, because, I mean, I was doing lots of other things, and I, even with Fishboy, which I stuck at, nobody else ever drew an episode or a panel of Fishboy. I did the whole of that stint. So I must have had some sort of professional pride, but somehow it wasn't as deep as with Marnie. I could sense with Marnie that there was something else here I could really get into, as well as doing a strip which is exciting and people liked. You could say something about, you know, the landscape, because I was living on the boat at the time, and it was an idyllic existence. You know, if I worked late at night or early in the morning, I would see kingfishers coming and landing on my mooring ropes and things like that. So I suppose it just happened at that time of my life when I was very into the countryside, and I could really put all of that into the strip.
You mentioned Tarka the Otter as an influence. When I was reading it, I was struck by kind of similarities to things like Watership Down. Even something like Bambi, to be honest with you. How much were you aware at the time? How much did it play on your mind? How much did it influence what you were doing, that this was still a comic book for children? But as I referenced earlier, has a slightly darker edge. You know, there is threat, there is real danger.
I think that was it, because there was an element of it. You know, there are so many, it's very psychological in a way, because there are so many thought balloons and so few speech balloons that you are always, you know, the main character, Marnie, is always front and center. And so I suppose that in itself was very involving. And, you know, I was having to hunt out photographs of foxes and things. So I think I just got very involved in the animal kingdom.
Having done Fishboy, which obviously involved an awful lot of drawing different types of fish, and then doing something like Marnie, what were you doing for reference on these? Because it's not as simple as it is now, just Googling something.
Oh, no. I mean, really, modern artists don't know they're alive. I had about three well-thumbed books. I had a sort of Fishes of the World paperback, I seem to remember, and I got most of my stuff from there. But, yeah, I mean, I was always haunting the library to look for more reference books. I mean, it was... That was fairly simple for Fishboy and for Marnie, because the reference was there. What was a real, real toughie was when I was put on to do, one of the things I would have been doing at the same time was Star Trek.
Oh, wow. Something a bit different.
They sent me a paperback, a sort of autobiography of Gene Roddenberry, which had about 8 or 10 photographs in it. And that was it. I couldn't find photographs of these guys anywhere. So I was cutting, you know, I used to thumb through the Radio Times every week to hope there would be a photograph alongside of Spock or Kirk alongside the latest episode. So it was a nightmare.
And having talked to artists about drawing things like horses Horses are the nemesis of many an artist in that they are very graceful, beautiful creatures, but don't really make an awful lot of sense when you're trying to render them on the page.
They always look improbable. You know, yes. Even if you're following a photograph, it ends up looking. You think that can't be right. You know, that's not natural. They are very difficult. Different. Yes. Difficult. I mean,
that was going to be my question. Really, is about how much license you have to take with something that's based in nature. Where it may be, say, anatomically correct, it may be as it is in a photograph, but it may not necessarily look on the page. How much license did you give it?
You always try and make it as lifelike as you can. I suppose it's the audience, it's the viewer who gives you the license, because they either accept it or they don't. You do your best always to make it as lifelike as whatever reference you can find. I mean, but you know, reference only goes so far. When you've got a fox doing as much as Marnie did in those 2 years, then there is a time when you've just got to invent. And you try and make it as lifelike as you can, but ultimately the license has got to be given you by the reader, and they either do or they don't. There's nothing you can do about that.
You only spent 2 years on Marnie, but it still seems to be something that has really stayed with you and is something that you remember quite fondly. Why do you think that is?
I don't know, really. I mean, I've worked on a lot of other things. Often people, you know, send me something and say, did you do this? And I look at it and think, yes, I did, but for the life of me, I can't remember. I don't know what it was about Marnie. It was just, I suppose it was the reality of it, you know. It was just more real than anything else, even that I'd been asked to do. You know, there was no suspension of disbelief in believing that a boy could speak in bubbles underwater and that his hands would grow webbed. It was absolutely, completely as real as I could make it. I suppose it was that.
Thinking about it being reprinted now for the first time, and you did a delightful cover for the new edition. What was it like revisiting the character? And
it was lovely. Yes, yeah. I really enjoyed it. It just brought back to me, because it's so many years ago, Mike. I was shocked when I realized it was 1974. But yeah, it was great. I absolutely enjoyed it. And it's such a pleasure that it was that you chose to reprint. I'm so grateful to you.
No worries. No worries at all. I mean, it's a beautiful piece of work. And like I said, you know, evokes things to us like Worship Down, Tark of the Otter and whatnot. And I'm curious as to when you're dealing with animals, when you're dealing with non-human characters, and you're having to introduce quite strong emotions. So there's pathos in there, there's excitement, there's danger. How did you make these characters come alive in terms of their emotion? How do you make a fox, you know, seem panicked?
You put your finger on what was the toughest thing.
Right.
You know, you just, I suppose it was just trial and error and maybe that's why I was so involved in the thing, because you just had to be so empathetic. It's easy to draw a character, you know, a person looking angry or sad or whatever. But it's quite a different thing to put those emotions onto an animal. So I guess that's maybe why I got so involved in it, because it was just unlike anything. You know, I'd drawn hundreds of fish, but you didn't really have to draw a fish being thoughtful or despondent or whatever. They were just fish. But Marnie was different. So I guess I just had to think myself into his brain. In order to get the characterization right, maybe that's the answer to why it meant more to me than other stuff I'd done.
Did the story come to a natural end, or was it a decision that editorial made to close it?
I think really, I mean, it, 2 years. I'm surprised it lasted 2 years, really, because there's only so much that a fox can go through. It was just one darn thing after another, anyway. And some of his adventures were beginning to get a bit improbable, I think. So probably Scott thought it's time to finish it now. So as far as I remember, he meets a vixen on Dartmoor, and they settle down, and one hopes live happily ever after. But I think it had reached its natural conclusion. I presume there were talks between between the editor and Scott. Len Wen, that was the editor.
Right, right.
A lovely man. He was the most gentlemanly, courteous, considerate editor you could ever hope to have.
Excellent, excellent. How important do you think it was that Marnie had a happy ending, as you put it?
Oh, I think it would have been dreadful if he'd succumbed in the way that his siblings did in episode one or two, whenever they're gassed or shot or whatever happened to them. It just had to. I mean, you couldn't have any other ending, could you? Certainly not in 1974. Maybe now you could. maybe Judge Dredd could come along and exterminate him. But in those days, I mean, there would have been riots, I think.
Yeah.
Because some people got very involved in it. It's funny. Len used to have a poll every week. Yeah. He would invite readers to write in and for their most favourite and their least favourite story. And because it was so overtly emotional and, well, I don't know, just generally out of the run of the rest of the comic, regularly it used to be the most and the least favourite in the same week. So it was obviously a bit of a Marmite strip. Some people couldn't stand it because and some people really loved it, but I guess you could only put up with that for so long before everybody decided they hated it for its sentimentality.
It strikes me as a very 1970s strip. You know, you have that kind of first wave of environmentalism in the 70s. This a lot of literature about the countryside, particularly about the English countryside.
That's right.
And, yeah. and even TV series like The Good Life, you know, which kind of gently mock.
You're absolutely right. I think Scott really tapped into a feeling that was prevalent at the time.
Do you think it's the kind of strip that a young person could read today?
Well, that's going to be demonstrated next month, isn't it? I really don't know.
Well, fingers crossed. Fingers crossed.
I couldn't say. I mean, things have changed so much. We'll just have to see.
Okay. Let's talk about what happened in your career after Marnie, because by the mid-70s, things were starting to change in comic books. The pace of change was starting to quicken. And only within a few years did you have Action and then 2000 AD come along, and all the venerable titles like Buster and Lion and
they all
Valiant.
Began to die off.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. But you kept working. Was this because you changed with it, or just because there was some element?
In a sense, I mean, the whole business split into two. And I had never worked with any of the editors who went on to form 2000 AD. But I had worked with Des Skin, who left Freeway altogether and moved to Marvel UK. And when he was setting up his first weekly comic, he had the idea that he would have the Hulk Weekly, which was British in the sense it had British artists, and also had, unlike the American comics, it had our format of sort of, what would have been 9, 15 or so panels per two pages. So he tried to bring that into the American format of superheroes and things, and he got in touch with me and asked me to do Black Knight. And so I until much later on, until the late 80s, I don't think I did anything for 2000 AD, and then I used to do the odd Future Shocks now and again. But mostly I seem to have hitched my wagon to that particular star, which proved to be, you know, it waned fairly quickly. Marvel UK lasted for about, what, 8 or 10 years, was it? Maybe less.
Somewhere around there. I'm interested to see. Were you ever a comic book reader? I mean, you know, you'd encountered them when you were a boy, but when you're working in the industry, were you reading comics? Were you looking at other comics?
I was looking at British comics.
Right.
But I had no idea about American comics. I just didn't see them at all. I don't know how that happened. And it wasn't until Paul Neary was the art editor on the Hulk Weekly. Mm. And he used to send me photocopies of people like John Buscema and said, can you do something a bit more like this? You're looking a bit British. Because, you know, the first sort of four or five episodes of the Hulk were really bad when I look at them. I hadn't got the style at all.
Mm.
And so it was him that introduced me to this. And that, again, was my second great revelation. That was like, you know, buying the Eagle for the first time.
Mm.
To suddenly see that there was a whole different channel that was going along, which was completely different to anything I'd ever done.
What was the difference between your style before that point and your style afterwards? How did you change to make yourself more like American comics?
It was mostly things like, you know, the stance of the figures, the exaggeration, the generally taking things to a different level. No British, you know, if somebody punched something else, both their feet were on the ground, their bodies weren't pushed too far forward in the sort of British comic I'd been doing.
Mm.
And then I was seeing these American comics where the action was so exaggerated that, you know, they'd push themselves forward, they were balancing on one foot, their arm had gone past to an improbable degree. Every action seemed to be taken to its logical conclusion, whereas we had been, you know, just holding back and showing the action in quite a discreet sort of form. Everything just seemed bigger and brasher and more demonstrated.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose it's the difference, you know, you look like a British actor of the time, like Trevor Howard, and compare him to Marlon Brando. You know? It was just that difference of one was restrained and genteel and the other was right in your face.
Mm. You mentioned that this was another moment like when you'd read The Eagle for the first time. Was it a change that you felt comfortable with? Was it a change that you were happy to adapt to?
Given that I was working on The Black Knight at the time, yes, I mean, it helped me immensely.
Yeah.
And you know, the strip would just not have lasted if I hadn't changed style.
Mm. And the people you were working with at the time, I mean, you've already mentioned Deskin, Paul Neary, but you were drawing scripts not just for Marvel UK, but also for 2000 AD, with people like Alan Moore.
Alan Moore, yes, Grant Morrison.
Yeah.
I mean, gladly, both of them have overcome those early setbacks and they've gone on to do pretty well. But yeah, I think I did the first piece of writing that Grant Morrison ever did for Fleetway, and certainly very early Alan Moore strips. And they were great. That was, again, you know, so different from everything I'd worked on before.
I mean, just from your comment, I guess the answer to this is yes, but how aware were you of their level of talent that was going to go on and do other things? You know, was this stuff really so very different to what you'd encountered
it
before?
It was. Yeah? I mean, just the way they wrote around the subject in the script, they brought in background information instead of just saying, you know, so-and-so runs along the beach and does such and such.
Mm.
They would bring in philosophical concepts and things like this. It was just obviously a different level with both of them.
How did that change you as an artist? Did it push you? Did it make you, you know, adapt so that you were trying to match some of these ideas?
I guess it. I hope it did. Mm. Yeah, yeah. I certainly tried. Whether I succeeded or not is another matter. But I certainly did try. Yeah, in the way that with Marnie, I tried to change and up my style to match this huge realism of the scripts.
You then, I find it fascinating that you had this grounding in what I suppose a lot of people would think of as more kind of classic British comics, you know, the old school. And then not only are you working with Alan and Grant at Marvel UK on things like Hulk Weekly, Darth Vader, 2000 AD, you then end up being the inker on The Invisibles with Grant and you know, various other people. And I mean, that's a remarkable chain.
Well, despite trying to sort of change, there was a time in the late 70s, early 80s, when my style was, I mean, you know, 2000 AD was coming out, there were new artists coming in and doing new things, and my style was, frankly, really old-fashioned, and I was getting less and less work, and I was doing more and more in the theatre, and I met Barry Kitson. And I introduced him to the guys at Marvel UK, and he started working for them. And then he was just—he was younger, he was more clued up. He knew more about the American market and got in touch with them. And then he said to me, "I said my comic career is just about gone, Barry. I'm going to be a set designer from now on." And he said, "Well, you know, come and ink for me, where I'm doing this thing." I think it was Legion. It used to have the name, the date of the actual publication, so it would have been Legion 1999 or something like that. And he said, "Well, you know, I need an inker. Come and ink for me." And really, he took me by the bootstraps and re-educated me in what was needed for the American comics. And so I inked for him for a long while, and then I would gradually, an editor would say, they got this guy called Phil Jimenez, can you do a story for him? And eventually Phil and I became sort of an art team. And Grant wanted us to, he published the first volume of Invisibles, and for volume two he wanted to change of style, and that was having two artists doing most of the work, because every episode of volume one of the Invisibles had been a different artist. So he wanted continuity, and luckily for us, we were the continuity he chose. So that was how I got to do the Invisibles, and from being a sort of wildly out of date artist who you couldn't get arrested, let alone get a job, I was suddenly inking what was somebody in one of the fan magazines said was the coolest comic on the newsstand.
I mean, that is incredible. You have adapted. You've been in the right place at the right time, known the right people to be introduced to a slightly different way of thinking that's made your style a bit more evergreen than it might have otherwise been.
I suppose so, yes. I mean, I was very lucky, and as I say, I do owe that, all of that, to Barry. He was marvellous. He shook me up and set me on the right road.
I'll repeat a question I asked earlier when talking about Paul Neary showing you the kind of Steve Buscema style inks and things like that. When it was Barry showing you a different way of doing things, what was the change that you then made in your style when you started inking things like Legion and things like the Invisibles?
Well, the stuff, I suppose the thing about American inking was that when you do everything yourself, you take the script, you do the pencil roughs and everything, and the inking is always the final thing. You don't think about line weights or gradations or any of that stuff. In a way, I started to over Marnie, because I started to try and make it more textual. But when you get fully finished pencils and your job is to ink them, then you can be really particular, and you can make sure that your line weight is perfect to bring that figure forward and drop that background back. You get really involved in the techniques of it, and that was a revelation to me. Inking had always been a fairly mechanical thing of just, you know, making it presentable in order that it could be reproduced. Once I started working on other people's pencils, then it became an art form in itself, and I think that refined my work a lot.
You don't work for American Comics anymore. Is there a reason for that? Is it something that you've just moved on from, or was it outside forces?
I think it was I mean, I don't know. I had worked for, I worked myself into a bit of a side alley with Vertigo on the Invisibles. Yeah. And then when Phil pulled out, I carried on inking the Invisibles. And in fact, I was the last inker on it. I probably worked on that comic more than any other artist, but I stuck with the same editor. I then went on with her, Shelley Roberg, who became Shelley Bond. Mm. I then went on with her to American Century. And it was a bit like what happened to British comics. The figures were dropping. They were selling less and less. And Vertigo got to be a bit of a back alley. And I'd worked myself out of any association with any editors that I could go back to after all that length of time. So I guess it was a natural progression. And I was beginning to get more interested in the theatre. So I, you know, when American Century ended and nothing else appeared, I just went back to theatre naturally, and I worked there for many, you know, quite a few years.
Mm. Yeah, you kept in comics despite you know, focusing more on the theatre side, because you did Tales of Telgoose first.
Time,
yeah,
yes, that's right, I did, because I then tied up with Bargain Press. Barry, my memory is getting terrible, Mike. That again, like Len Wen, it'll come to me in a few minutes.
No worries.
Let's just hope it's before this conversation ends. But so he valiantly did his best to find me the odd Future Shocks on 2000 AD and a lot of football stuff I did at that time for some reason.
I mean, was that kind of Roy the Rovers or Striker? Or...
A lot of them were in Roy the Rovers or Score.
Mm.
I don't think I ever did the actual Roy of the Rovers strip, because that was already, you know, in very safe hands. But things like Project 917, I think one of them was, and another thing about a football team that was made up of ex-prisoners, ex-cons. So many of them, and they I don't remember at all. You know,
I
see them now, and I think, yeah, that's me, but I really can't remember doing it, because you know, that was at the same time that I was working in the theatre, so they all sort of merged into a oneness.
Let's talk about the thing that you've done most recently, which is a strip in the forthcoming Scream and Misty special, where we're reviving the 13th Floor.
Yes.
That's an old favourite of mine. I'm sure it is of many of our listeners, and not least because of Jose Ortiz's amazing
artwork. Yes.
What did when Keith Richardson approached you to do that? What was your reaction?
Well, I remembered the strip, and I said, yeah, I'd love to do it. But then he sent me some reference, and among that reference was obviously an annual job or something, where I'd actually done a story about a cat burglar who falls foul of Max. And I was astonished, because that was another of those stories I just did not remember. But I'd obviously done my best in that story to do a sort of faux Ortiz style with limited success. But yeah, it was lovely to do that.
We're reviving Scream and Misty for this special. There seems to have been, not least with the demand for the reprints now that we have the IPC catalogue, but there seems to have been a demand for these classics from the 1970s and 80s to see the light again. It seems that they had a remarkable influence. They had a remarkable reach that many of the creators, I think, don't necessarily know that they did. I mean, is this the case for you? Were you aware of just how many people the strips you were working on were reaching? Or was that distance between you and the process, between you and editorial, did that keep you fairly insulated?
Absolutely. I had no idea. It always used to astonish me when someone would say, oh, you're John Stokes, you did Fishboy or whatever, because I just thought, how did you know that? it just seems incredible that we were such, as I say, we were, you know, little isolated agents working in tiny cells. Mm. But no, it was and still is a profound shock to find that people have actually been following you as an artist. That is just incredible.
If you don't mind me asking, how old are you now?
I am 77.
77. Now. Wow. That is a hell of a long career.
Yes. That's why I have trouble remembering. It seems just so long ago that I got, you know, the first thing I did for Fleetway on a weekly basis was a thing, I suppose it was in Tiger, I don't know. No, I don't think so. It was a new publication that was printed in a larger format, and it was a thing called Crisis Carson. It just, and I look back on it, and it's just a different person who did that, who is for some reason masquerading under my name.
And I presume you still work traditionally. There's no kind of digital element to your work.
Well, no. After I'd, you know, I stopped doing comics, the Bardon Press, I think they gave up. Barry, oh, I wish I could remember his name. He retired. And so I did. I no longer had an agent, and I really had no idea how to get work. I started to do things like, you know, material for the museums and things like that, and
okay.
Attractions, one-off illustrations. You know, if they wanted something to show Viking life or Iron Age life or whatever, I would do them. And the people I was working for said to me one day, you know, John, we really can't be scanning all your stuff. It doesn't sound a laborious job, but they had lost patience with it. You're going to have to go digital. And so I was thinking they were talking, you know, in a year or two. And yeah. I sort of said, okay, fine, I'll do that. When do you think I should start? And they said, well, you've got a piece coming in next Tuesday. Why don't, you know, colour that up on Photoshop? Well, I mean, talk about a steep learning curve. I think you could probably hear me swearing from Oxford. But I mean, it was a terrible piece of work, but I did get it done. And I always draw. I still do the black and white drawings by hand. But then I do everything else in Photoshop, which is brilliant.
I mean, oh, God. Well, I was just about to ask if you were happy with the change.
It's got so, I mean, I still do the odd bit of scene painting or whatever, and I just think, oh dear, that's gone wrong. Where's the, you know, the repeat button, or how do I go back to that stage, undo stage?
Yeah.
It just gets to be second nature, and you never have to think, can I mix that colour again? How did I get that colour? It's so liberating.
One thing I did want to ask about, you got into art, into illustration because of your elder brother George.
Yes.
What was his career like in illustration?
He started. He got into, I suppose it was the Express with people like Sid Bicknell. Sid was drawing Jeff Hawke. George was doing quite a groundbreaking strip called Wesley Slade, about a U.S. Marshal who unusually took the side of the Indians in the Indian Wars and things like that. So he wrote and drew that for many years. And then after that, he illustrated quite a few books like How to Play Golf for Jack Nicklaus, things like that. But he died very early. He'd had a heart condition ever since he was a young man. So he died at the age of about 46, I think it was.
Right.
So he didn't have a long career.
But it's interesting that he maintained that kind of, I suppose you call it a traditional commercial illustrator aspect to him, where you kind of went full comics.
Yes.
So it's looking back on your career, you've already mentioned about how, you know, there's been this profound change, not just in the industry, but in how you do comics. You know, you've been able to switch between doing your work in the theatre and doing your work in comics. What's your feeling about your career now, looking back on it, looking back on those decades of work?
I'm in two minds about it, Mike. I think if I'd been more single-minded and stuck to just one thing, I would have done better.
Mm.
Because of the sort of grounding I had, I think even when I was a youngster of about 21, 22, when I first started drawing, my style was already a bit old-fashioned. Mm. I've never been an innovator in the way that the group of artists who started 2000 AD were. So in that sense, I was born an old fogey as far as drawing was concerned, because at art school I was seeing people like Arthur Rackham and those 19th century illustrators,
mm.
and thinking, this is the way one must draw. So a lot of people used to look at my stuff and think, cross-hatching, oh my God, don't do that, it's so old-fashioned. But it's just what I grew up with, and I've never been able to get over it. So I have managed to change, but had I had those influences earlier, I think I might have done better,
mm.
and changed more greatly. I've always, in a sense, I've always had that slightly old-fashioned, British comics of the 60s style, which might be an anvil about my neck, I don't know. Or it might be that now it's so old-fashioned that, it's fashionably retro. You don't know.
I just love the idea of you having had this career and getting to the point where you're you still have quite a traditional style and working with one of the then enfant terrible of comics in with somebody like Grant Morrison, where it's such a contrast in backgrounds between,
yes.
between you and him. It really does bring a smile to my face.
It is strange, isn't it? Yes. I mean, I don't know what Grant must have thought when he suddenly realised that he'd inherited me as part of his package on The Invisibles. I mean, did he groan inwardly and think, oh my God, that's volume two gone up the twist.
Because as part of all of that, you inked Frank Quitely fairly early on in his
career. In fact, I was his very first inker.
Wow.
He'd always inked his own stuff up until then, and I did speak to him on the phone, and I said, "You're not going to enjoy it, because you have done these things with your pencils, and someone else is going to come and just no matter how you try to be faithful, your own style does come through."
Sure.
And at about the same time, I had for the first time had my pencils inked by someone else, and it is not a pleasant experience. So I really felt for Frank. But I think he wasn't too upset at the outcome, because he then, on the very last episode of Invisibles, he and I came back and did that together.
Well, John, I've now run out of time to chat, but this has been an utterly delightful talk. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's been lovely, Mike. Thank you so much.
I hope you enjoyed that chat with John as much as I did. It's absolutely delightful to hear not just about Marnie the Fox, but also his wider career. Make sure you pick up the collected edition of Marnie the Fox out next month from the Treasury of British Comics. There's more to come from our new imprint, republishing the best of classic British comics from the 1970s and 80s. We've got the Dracula File coming up, as well as the collection of The 13th Floor, and we're going to have some podcast episodes in future weeks that focus on these new releases. I'm going to try and make sure that we keep the 2000 AD content separate from the Treasury of British Comics content. So might see some little changes in the 2000 AD forecast in the months to come. But until next time, Earthlits and readers everywhere, Splendid Berthrig.
Fell power levels dangerously high. Alert! Alert! Read 2000 AD every week. Ask your comic book store or newsagent now. Subscribe to the galaxy's greatest comic at 2000adonline.com. Subscribe digitally on our apps for Apple, Android, and Windows 10. And download DRM free copies from 2000adonline.com. Alert! Alert!
Stand by for urgent updates. Search for 2000 AD on Twitter and Facebook. Watch the latest videos at youtube.com/2000AD online. And follow on Instagram at Insta2000AD. Program complete. Shutting down.